In the mid-1980s, when I was at Hokyoji in Minnesota one time, a priest who was in training at another center came for our month-long Ango in anguish. And he focused his question, his anguish, on, does Zazen work? Because his whole Sangha was in crisis. Everything was turning upside down. Everyone in the whole group was feeling betrayed, either by the teacher or by the people who felt betrayed by the teacher and wanted the teacher to leave. Everybody was in a complete upheaval. All these years of Zazen. Well, was it good for anything? It was a heartfelt question. Granted, that was a kind of a narrow way, in some ways, a narrow way to focus the this question of his life. But he was saying, what have I been doing all this time? Does Zazen work, he said, over and over. All those years of sitting, and look what can happen, right in the middle of it, even. And that question has echoed for me off and on. But the question is, does Zazen work? How? Work for what? What do you want it to work for? You know, I've said for years with Sawaki Roshi and Uchiyama Roshi, Sawaki Roshi said, Zazen is good for nothing. Right? And that's like the sign over the entrance that says, abandon hope, all ye who enter. But just hope as you have known it, perhaps, maybe. He said, Zazen is good for nothing. And then the other shoe drops, until you really get that. Zazen is good for nothing means we're always trying to shape it into a means to our ends, our somewhat narrow ends, our goals that we can conceive of. And when we do that, we undercut our practice terribly. It can't do very much for you. It might actually help you meet your ends, but that's not what it's about. That's not enough. So Zazen is good for nothing until you get that. But once you get that it's not a manipulating event, and you stop trying to turn awareness into something else, then it is truly useful. It's useful for getting at the truth of things and orienting you toward connecting with what you see. And then what? Last week I was talking about awareness, and I went on thinking about that, and I was specifically saying Buddha Dharma awareness. That's to say, there are all kinds of awarenesses in this world. Awareness as an activity of life that we participate in and that expresses the universe. That's Buddha Dharma awareness. Zazen is one of its forms. It's awareness without a particular goal, but with a framework, a context of meaning, called saying that if you look with a broad awareness, you will see is an interconnected universe. What you'll see is an impermanent universe of coming and going. And if you, without trying, but if as soon as we try to say, I'm going to see a doctrine called impermanence, you know, the beautiful goddess of awareness has fled. And the premise is that this is a universe like that, interconnected, interdependent, endlessly moving, and that we can be aware of that. Or we can be aware in a way that takes part in that, even when we're not saying, oh, that's what I'm being aware of. Participating in the universe being interdependent. So what happens next? What does awareness work? Does Zazen work? Does awareness work? What good is it on this planet? Because I think to say that Zazen is is its own activity, does not we don't want to separate us from the world. Therefore, it has to connect in some way to life on this planet. Does it work? Does it contribute? What is its relationship? What good is it on this planet? So I started thinking first that it's rooted in each individual, right? We have minds. It's kind of a birthright. We are designed to be aware. The brain is cut out for that. And then, of course, we learn to refine that and develop that and also to abuse it. But we learn to refine it greatly. We're designed for it as a natural way of taking part in the world. Awareness is where the self is in the world, things coming in and being processed, and that is who I am, and that is what is out there, and that interchange. So awareness never takes place outside of an endless universe. So even if you do say, there's this personal little brain in here, or body, it's not just the brain that's having this awareness, all these sensory connections. But this little mushroom is itself already part of the universe. It's not just, we're none of us just our own personal concern. We're the universe expressing itself. We're all natural beings. We're all organic. In that sense, we're all naturally occurring parts of the universe. It's not me and the universe. We're already in it. And so this awareness that we have is a quality of the universe and a quality of connecting this individual, knitting this individual into the universe. So it's a huge force. Awareness is then a huge universal force. It's a force that extends seamlessly from the individual behind my eyeballs out through the whole world, the whole of Indra's net. Indra's net says that each is connected to all and each is the expression of all. Some of you may not know, it's a wonderful image, Indra's net. Indra was one of the chief gods of the Hindu pantheon. And Indra's net is a huge net extending over the entire universe. And at every crossing of the strands of this enormous web is a jewel reflecting the entire universe. And the jewel that is an intersection and a reflection and an expression of the whole universe. No one part is separate from the whole. Everything is included. And so this is one of the great strengths of Buddha Dharma awareness, is that it's not just a thing you do and you pick up and you put down. It's already there. We pick up our awareness. We refine it and then we forget and put it away in a drawer somewhere with mothballs. But Buddha Dharma awareness is here radiating out all the time. And it ties your welfare together with the welfare of the rest of the world because they're not separate. We're not separate beings. We're not separate awarenesses. This is not your personal. You know, it's if you happen to be born pretty or plain, it's not really your virtue. It's the universe can happen to come up that way. What you do with it, what you do with your birthright of intelligence or prosperity or awareness, that is our responsibility. But it's already here. The universe happens to express itself as Jude. And then Jude figures out what to do with that. As part of a whole universe. You never have to figure it out all by yourself. We think of ourselves as alone, but you never have to figure it. You can't figure it out all by yourself because you aren't all by yourself. That's part of our delusion. So I see it as one of the core strengths of Buddha Dharma awareness is that it naturally radiates out because it is naturally widely occurring and because it is an experience of receiving, giving and receiving. Something to build on. So I have found in my own life that in my own individual personal life, this kind of Buddha Dharma awareness is extremely productive. And I told a dream a couple of weeks ago that had to do with how important a role awareness had. And I realized in this dream I was aware and aware and aware and aware, and it created possibilities. And I realized that that's what my toolkit is awareness. And Buddha Dharma awareness. It has become an awareness in this kind of just naturally trying to be aware. Of course, I'm not always. But that's what my energy, my life energy, goes in the direction of wanting to be aware of what's happening around me, in me, and between. And that this is something that many years of practice of Zazen and Buddha Dharma have encouraged. So then I said, well, can this Buddha Dharma awareness be productive for the world as it is productive for me? Is it just something that guides my personal life so that I don't fall off a cliff? Or can it be equally productive for the world in crisis? And are those two separate questions? Because this week I found, as I thought about, is there a direction I could take this thinking about awareness in that would be productive and not just sort of repeating? Everywhere I turned, there was another book or report on something to do with the climate crisis. Climate change, policy, glacier loss, proposals for nuclear energy, and the terrible oil spill. And this morning's paper said, oh, it's several magnitudes worse than any of the assessments have been, because all the assessments have looked at a sort of surface layer, and there's apparently deep, huge river of oil flowing out on deep down, so that it's several times worse than the assessments have been so far. One of the writers I've read this week said, we need a, this is what woke me up. He said, we need a huge behavioral shift in people worldwide. And he didn't know where to take that. And I said, oh, this is what Buddha Dharma awareness is about. Maybe it has something to offer worldwide or beyond where we know it can go. Maybe Buddha Dharma awareness can be the root or a root of that kind of shift. And there's no way to know now. You can't say, oh, I know it will do that. Who knows? We don't know what is a powerful force enough to shift things in the world. You can't know ahead of time in an impermanent universe. So I thought, well, how do I begin to refine thinking about does this Buddha Dharma awareness connect with our world in crisis? And well, one of the first aspect of this awareness that I see always is clarity. It matters to be clear. You could say it doesn't matter, but then you wouldn't be here. You declare it matters, and you take it up. You're putting your precious life energy into an effort to wake up to life. And we say, oh, I want to be peaceful. Oh, I want to understand things. We give it various names, and that's fine. But we're doing something larger than any one of the names, includes whatever ideas we have about it. We're doing something that's very large, and we're putting some of our precious life energy into this. So it matters. We're already convinced it matters, or at least testing it out for a lifetime or two. So I'm saying that it matters to you and to the world, this clarity. It's receptivity. This kind of awareness is a receptive awareness, an awareness of possibility. And any act of this kind of Buddha Dharma awareness, let's call it awareness, is affirms yourself and the world around you, because it's not a solipsistic, some kind of just inner awareness. There's no such thing as just inner. You know, the inner experience is always is valuable, but it's already part of the universe. When you just look inside at your own, self, you're looking at the part of the universe happening, a valuable part that needs to be cared for. And I look at somebody else's innards, and I see something, another inner life that needs care. These are all valuable, and they're not separate from the fact that this awareness is always looking out and looking in, always receiving, always seeing, looking and at a world of possibility. As telling you, we're always, this is an awareness that's always receiving the shouts and murmurs of the world. And it's always saying, keep looking. Maybe it's hard to look. Keep looking. We learn that inside ourselves and we learn that outside. We have to keep looking. Just because we don't know what to do doesn't mean we should stop looking. It means all the more keep looking. And what is a ground for that keeping on looking? Well, it's disheartening to keep looking when things look, you can't see way to go forward. It's very disheartening. So you say, it's disheartening because I don't know the way forward, but here I am looking and I'm already participating. To be looking is already to be participating. You know, the old saying was, it the 60s or 70s, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Awareness is already part of the solution. We don't know where it'll take. It's already affirming and receiving and connecting. And it says, pay attention. So the broad awareness says, pay attention. Pay attention to your own actions and to their consequences. Don't push away awareness. Don't push away awareness of consequences. That's your life happening. So I think the quality of our regard for the world is the quality of our life. It never works to draw a fence in close and say, I can only take care of this narrow arena. I cannot pay attention to what's beyond it. And cut it off, because you cut off yourself. You cut off your largeness. Your own life, our own lives shrink when we do that. The quality of our regard for our world is the quality of our own life. And we walk so heavily on the planet. Can we afford to hear it? We can't afford not to. We don't know what to do. See, it's very important to say, you know, this is like repentance in Zen Buddhism, in much of Buddhism, where it's a matter of saying, oh, I will look, I will avow that this is as it is. And then, if I can figure out a next step, I find a next step. But for now, this moment's work is to say, this is as it is, and I can afford to look at it. I really can't afford not to. We, all of us, are eating up the world in our desire to be comfortable. But that won't make us comfortable if we eat up the world. And in the name of freedom, but it isn't to be driven by grasping, is not freedom. And then the rest of the world that isn't have the same, those who don't have the same opportunities, alternately envies us and resents us, because everyone would like to be in our shoes and then be doing the same thing. So that's not a good solution, to say I'll go somewhere else or not live here. We're who we are and we live here. One of the articles I read, I think it was in the New Yorker, was about an inventor who's dedicated all his work to things that will be essentially green inventions, things that will support lower tech impact technologies or various kinds of things like that. He invented something quite brilliant and then discovered it wasn't needed. And that cued him in it's not enough to have a brilliant awareness and have a great solution. I forget what it was for. Something really nifty. It really worked well and made this, whatever it was, cheap. But it wasn't necessary. It was the wrong solution. There already was another solution coming in that worked better. And so when at the end of his article, he says, right now, the main thing I'm working on is trying to invent my way out of my own hypocrisy. Let me say that one again. Right now, the main thing I'm working on, he said, the main thing I'm working on is trying to invent my way out of my own hypocrisy. Pretty good. Now that's our open-minded clarity. This is the being able to afford to say, you know, I think my views are riddled with hypocrisy. I better pay attention. I can't afford not to. I can, my hypocrisy isn't worse than anybody else's. I love you. I can probably stand to look at my own, you know. What happens when we pay attention that way, in a world where our awareness is part of a world of connection, is that our awareness is awareness of connection and is an act of connection. Empathy is one of the aspects of that. So this awareness that is honed as an expression of Buddha Dharma, as an expression of I live in an active, interconnected universe, leads us, this kind of awareness leads us to awareness of connection, to seeing in terms of the connections. And that this is a natural, this connectedness is already a natural condition of life, and sometimes I'm aware of it, and sometimes I'm not. And the awareness, like the universe, is with me everywhere, even when I forget completely about it. The aware Dharma universe is always present in us and as us. And so our awareness is never just our own personal event, and is never apart from us either. So our experience of ourselves and our experience of the world don't need to be seen as two separate things. And what about when we're not aware? Which, after all, is a lot of the time. That's the trying to invent our way out of our own hypocrisy is our original hypocrisy before we're trying to invent our way out of it is that going to sleep and not noticing and not being aware. Oh, I'm just living my own little life here. That's actually not too accurate. I think one of the worst problems for humans generally is not even just being unaware, but the delusion that we're being aware, that we know what we're doing, that we're doing the right thing. There's nothing to do about that except to keep waking ourselves up and to keep putting ourselves in places and in company that encourage waking up, saying, oh, you think you're awake? Wait a minute, open your eyes. Wait a minute, open your eyes. You know, the times, even in Zazen, it's sleepy and your eyes start to close. You don't notice it at first. You think you're sitting there alert until you realize that your head is nodding. But there was some time in between those two when you weren't aware of that, right? So the head nodding isn't such a bad thing. It says, oh, I'm here. Once I actually, years and years ago in Minnesota, I fell asleep and actually hit my head on the wall in front of me. And, oh, there I was, you know. I was doing Zazen in the Buddha Hall in Minneapolis. We think, for instance, as we plan our summers maybe, that if we can afford the cost of airfare and we have a good reason to go somewhere, we should feel free to fly hither and thither. And maybe we add a factor of busyness. Am I already busy? Will it make my life busier? But we're overlooking then so many other factors, like the energy drain of flying, the harm the jets do to the atmosphere. And if we look widely and include many factors as our own lives, it's one of the problems is that everything seems like a chore if it's out there. Here's my life and here's something out there I ought to pay attention to. No, taking it in as our own life to pay attention to shifts the equation. It benefits our lives to broaden the base of what we consider to be our lives. And looking widely in an inclusive way benefits us, benefits others. I think that's the only way we'll have some impetus towards overcoming that kind of inertia and of that turns into hypocrisy that we all fall into. It's that dualistic mind that says, my life is over here, and that is out there, and I really just can't quite afford to pay attention to it. Another aspect of Buddha Dharma awareness is, as I was saying last week, there's consequences. I call it consequential. It leads to other actions, which is one reason I think it has a productive quality in itself. When you take part in an open system of exchange where things are received, as long as there's life, there's receiving and giving, there's motion, there's going to be change, there's going to be consequences. one thing happens and another thing happens. If we live in a cause and effect universe, then there are consequences. And awareness itself is an action with consequences. So there was, of course, the one or two happy stories. There was a reminder that this month is the anniversary of the discovery of the ozone hole 25 years ago over Antarctica. And it was 15 years ago that an international treaty actually happened and actually was put into effect that leading to not using the fluorocarbons that were contributing to the ozone hole. But it was found. The ozone hole was found in Antarctica because some scientists had been quietly taking observations for decades already, not knowing that they weren't looking for an ozone hole. They were taking observations patiently. They were paying attention. And then suddenly when there seemed to be an anomaly and a shift, they had a basis from which to look back and say, oh, there's been a radical shift. So sometimes the paying attention is an essential part. It's not in itself sufficient, but we're saying that this kind of paying attention is itself also has consequences. In that case, the paying attention rippled out from decades of observations to people seeing this huge anomaly and seeing what's happening, figuring out what's happening, endless expansions of paying attention. Then there's the loss of glacier mass on the Tibetan plateau. It's one thing for the snows to retreat from Kilimanjaro, but the glaciers in the Tibetan plateau feed rivers that provide most of the crop irrigation for a very large part of Asia, and they're disappearing rapidly. How do we know how to? It's barely even being paid attention to. And there was one. Then another article said, "Well, there's one man who's creating mini glaciers up there. The glaciers are melting, but winter by winter, it's still cold. And so he's just on a very small scale started flooding small valleys. And then in the spring, as the water melts, getting that captured into crop irrigation." And what about how we all consume coal and then belch out pollution in the air and the land? And so then we switch to oil, which is a little bit cleaner, and we look what's happening down in the ocean. So now we're going to wind up switching to more to nuclear energy. But we don't have a good safety record for coal and oil. So here we go. So this is this vast world out there. And it gets quite overwhelming because I really can't do much about the Tibetan plateau or about the shrinking of the glaciers. So what about me in my life? What about the awareness starting back here? And so I started thinking about what I do and I don't do. You know, I compost. It's fun, too. It's very productive. It's not hard if you have a little space. I turn off lights. I keep the heat down, more or less. And so I started thinking, as I was out driving in my car, I started thinking, there were two of us in the car, I started thinking about what I don't do and what I might do. I was on my way partly to a dumpster, to do some dumpster diving. So that's a good thing, real recycling. So I thought, well, why am I still using incandescent light bulbs? I have an attitude. Otherwise, I probably would have switched. I have an attitude about how they're dim or they're slow to start up. And I said, well, try it. Be curious. And then I said, well, what else can I do? I could turn the computer off more. It's more convenient just to flip the lid down on the laptop. But I could turn it off and stop that little slow drain that all those little appliances around the house have when they're left in their kind of dormant conditions. It'd be good, too, because I wouldn't go back to the computer as quickly if it took two more minutes to to boot up. Right? I would think twice, at least. What else did I do? I could borrow Elska's car more. She's got a Prius. She said that was all right. after I came up with my great way to save energy by driving her car. I could find out if a new furnace would save more energy. I could... And then I was thinking about driving. There's driving 5 miles an hour slower. Very interesting exercise. It saves a lot of energy to drive 5 miles an hour slower. Or the difference between 55 and 65 is quite significant in terms of pollution output. This is one of those things that falls in the heading of huge behavioral shift. So if I want to think of what it's like for the planet to make huge behavioral shifts, maybe I better try one myself, because it's a long-standing habit, and I like to kind of go perking along. You know, I mean, I'm not really slow that much of the time. I'm always perking along, so I want my car to perk along with me. You know, well, slowing down a little is very nice, especially if you're driving in Sonoma County. You know, we're not talking about I-5, although some of that's kind of pretty too. This is a lovely place. And there's probably something happening outside the window, and you're also less likely to hit the deer that runs across the road, or the cat, or the skunk. And you're likely to enjoy it more. And in fact, the act of moving at a more moderate pace is in itself pleasurable. But I like driving a little faster because it keeps all my synapses firing. It's kind of like it's a pachinko, the Japanese thing. It's like pinball, but it has many, 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 many little balls. Lights flashing and noise going, and people get really addicted to it because we like the sense, we like feeling our synapses flash. And but there are other things we could do to make them flash. So there's an real interesting place to look at my own life and sort of the addictive quality of some kinds of sensory overload. And what does it take to make a behavior shift? What does it take to be aware? And what does it take to say, okay, I'm aware, but I don't want to now. I'm wanting to hit the gas pedal. Was it? There's a sign that they have hanging from some lamppost in Santa Rosa that says, "There's two pedals." Hello, that's really a nice one. Is there something like try the other pedal for a change? No? I remember in the 70s, the oil embargo then, the problems we had then, and the high costs, it was a game to try to use as little gas as possible, accelerating very slowly, you know, not going fast, playing various games so you would also, so you wouldn't have to get into this alternate day going to the gas station and kind of stuff, in long lines. It was a major hassle. But there's an interesting study of my own sense of awareness and where I... grasping or playing, being hypocritical in my own sort of self-stimulating way with driving, as opposed to driving a way that benefits the planet and me equally. You know, I'm not going to stop flying, but I can take the planet's needs into account. And if I fly less, I don't think I'll enjoy life less. Actually, I don't fly that much because I don't like to, but I have thought generally in terms of, you know, do I want to go there? And do I have the money? Maybe there are more concerns, but those concerns are my concerns. How to make those concerns my concerns is really what I've been trying to figure out. There's always planting trees. It's currently one of my favorites. Elizabeth and I like to plant trees. And there is the knowledge that you're planting something that's good for the planet. Shifting that carbon balance a little bit. And then I went home and changed my light bulbs. I actually had some of those little fluorescent, compact fluorescents in a cupboard behind a door where they weren't doing anybody any good. And it was fun. Changing your light bulbs as an act of love is fun. So the what else, how do I develop these things, not as a chore, but as an act of loving connection. So what do we do? How do we revision so that it's not some thing we ought to do or we ought to harangue ourselves or others into doing, but an expression of our own life so that it is an act of love for ourselves and others to do something like changing the light bulbs or getting a solar audit to see if there's something else we could do, or thinking about, or driving slower, or for each of us there's different things. A good fit is when self and other benefit. It often is the case, we don't often know it, but the good fit is when benefiting others benefits yourself. We're not asked to somehow to benefit the planet as a sacrifice. It feels like that sometimes, but I don't think restraint is a sacrifice. But that's maybe that's for another day. So I think one of the very important places to start this is to sit zazen as part of your life on the planet, as part of being fully yourself, as part of being part of the planet, as part of generating awareness of life happening, and of being that, and of connecting. Zazen is a connected activity. It's not a separated, it's not a detached practice, ever. It's one reason we sit with our eyes open. A practice of coming to this present moment, to being here and now present, isn't just a description of a minor synaptic event. It is coming into this reality of this life and inhabiting it more with more awareness, taking full account and pleasure of where you already are. So commit yourself to your own life. Commit yourself to sit. Commit yourself to the planet. It's all one commitment. And wake up and change your light bulbs as an act of love. What will you do? Beyond whatever you do now, what else would you do? What more would you do out of basing it as deeply as possible, rooting your actions for the planet in as actions for yourself inseparably? They always are connected. What can you do different and more than you do now to expand the base of your own life? So I think changing light bulbs was an act of love because it was an act of my own life. I'm going to run out and buy some more compact fluorescent bulbs now and change some more.
Buy LEDs.
Buy LEDs?
No mercury. And way less power. More expensive. Over the life of that bulb, basically 34 years.
Okay. That's fine.
And they're pretty.